for John Morosi's Michigan Wolverines. How confident are you with the Badgers coming to town?
I would say, Clay, that I've been increasingly impressed with Michigan's play over time, and obviously I've been still keeping most of my attention on the baseball world, but I think it's steadily since that opening clunker against Notre Dame that Michigan has improved as the year has gone along. I think that's really a good sign, and a sign that it seems like the coaching staff and the players are on the same page right now. So I would say at home, I'm pretty confident Michigan wins that game, but I think it's going to be very close. And, of course, night game, Ann Arbor, I expect a dramatic finish one way or the other.
What do you think about Shea Patterson? I mean, we haven't really talked about him very much on this show since week one because there was a lot of discussion about him coming into the season. Then, like you said, Michigan kind of fell flat in the opener against Notre Dame, and they've won, I believe, five in a row since. This would be six in a row, and I think he's got 10 touchdowns, two interceptions. What kind of letter grade would you give Shea Patterson so far at the halfway point?
I think A-minus, and maybe just the one loss in Notre Dame would be the only reason why that there's the minus there. I think he's been the best playmaking quarterback probably that Harbaugh has had since he's come here, and increasingly impressed about his playmaking ability. I think he's a really good athlete, and you can tell there's a lot of poise there. His ability to use his legs to buy time in the pocket, I think, and outside the pocket has been impressive. So I think his decision-making has gotten better as the season's gone along, as his comfort with the offense has improved. So I'm on board. I've been very impressed. I think it's interesting. You think about the Big Ten and the lot of attention on Haskins and McSorley, so he's not the biggest name quarterback in the conference, but you know, if he wins on Saturday and if he finds a way to beat Michigan State in East Lansing the following weekend, I mean, two pretty big games in a row. I mean, at home, Wisconsin, and then on the road for Michigan State. If he finds a way to win both those games, I think that the national buzz surrounding him will increase a lot here in the next 10 days or so.
Speaking of national buzz, I said on my show yesterday, and I can't even think of another good analogy in the world of sports. For about 100 years, if you were a Red Sox fan, it meant that you were basically the redheaded stepchild of the Major League Baseball. You were certainly the much less in the rivalry, shining bright light compared to the New York Yankees. If you are like a 16-year-old kid right now, and there's probably some 16-year-old kids driving into school this morning with their parents or driving themselves in or whatever else, who grew up and they only know the Yankees-Red Sox rivalry in their own experience as one that the Red Sox own and dominate. That's a pretty seismic shift. You know, if you think about, like, over the trajectory of baseball, how long Red Sox fans were, like, the weak underling, the typical little brother, and now they have become the big brother. Can you think of very many even other sports analogies like that where now we've totally flipped it, and in the wake of their win over the Yankees, if you were talking to a kid, maybe even a 20-year-old now, and you were saying, hey, which is the more dominant franchise in that Yankees-Red Sox rivalry in your life, they'd be like, oh, the Red Sox by far.
Right, and that's a fascinating insight. It was interesting, actually, I think it was a couple nights ago, I saw Jeff Fletcher, a longtime baseball writer there in California, tweeted that he said his son was going to root for the Yankees because the exact quote was, the Red Sox have won the World Series so many more times in my lifetime. And
that's
basically exactly what you just said. That's now the prevailing opinion of, I guess, neutral sports fans that are under the age of 20. That's basically what it's become. And really, I think in Boston, I saw it start to turn a little bit, even when I was in college there again, early 2000s, right before the Red Sox won. Of course, the Patriots began to change it with their championship in the 01 season, and there was that time when basically in that decade the Bruins won it in 2011. So there was a span of time there, and then the Celtics had won it right around that time, I think 08, I believe it was. All four of the teams had won it in like a 2 or 3 year span, championships, which sort of changed fundamentally that the New England fatalism around sports and, oh, we're always going to lose and when's their shoe going to drop. It's changed fundamentally. I mean, Boston is now used to winning in everything, it seems. But I think most poignantly in their rivalry against the Yankees, I think you might say that towards the end of the time when the Giants and Dodgers were both playing in New York, the Giants had won championships and the Dodgers really hadn't. And then, of course, they moved to L.A. and it flips, and the Giants had not won in San Francisco until 2010. So that is a historic rivalry in baseball, certainly that maybe is the one parallel you would say. But you're right. I mean, it's almost without precedent that it would change that abruptly in a rivalry of this stature. But it has, and I think that right now you look at it, and I think the Yankees, it's important for Yankee fans and maybe for even for us in the media to not overreact too much to the way that series went. I mean, the Yankees still won 100 games, and Aaron Boone still had a pretty good season for a rookie manager. But I think the Red Sox were more talented, and Alex Cora, as a rookie manager himself, I think had a little bit of a better series than Aaron Boone did.
What happens now in the ALCS? You've got the defending World Series champs, Houston Astros, going up against the team that won the most games overall in the season, the Boston Red Sox. Who wins?
I think Houston does. I look at the way that they play together so well this time of year. I give a little bit of an edge to Houston's pitching. And listen, David Price is going to have to get big outs and probably win a game for the Red Sox at some point in time. David struggled again in the first round against the Yankees, and I've defended him a lot and will continue to. I think last year in the division series, he actually was probably Boston's best pitcher against the Astros, although he was pitching at the time out of the bullpen. I don't know if the Red Sox can win this series without David Price being David Price, and by that I mean the David Price of his regular season self. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's going to be such a fascinating series to watch, because I think everybody knows that it has to happen that way. They need him to do that. And I think Mookie Betts is going to have to, again, be his MVP self from the regular season to really get back on track, I think, for the Red Sox offense. So I think it's going to come down to a couple key guys, and also Kimbrel. Kimbrel, to me, that was a very much a wobbly ninth inning there in game four in the Bronx. So I think that the key guys right now, I don't know if I'll say the pressure's on them, but I think the guys that I'm watching the most right now, Betts, Price, Kimbrel. I think they're all going to be really key for the Red Sox. If they all come up big, the Red Sox can win. If they don't, I think that you look at the postseason know-how of the defending World Series champions and say that the Astros probably find a way to win this series.
What about the NLCS? Are the Dodgers going to advance to play for a second straight season into the World Series, or do you think the Brewers? And I know we talk a lot about title deficits. I think the Brewers have not been in the World Series since 1982. I mean, that is a long ass time for a franchise to not be relevant, kind of on that national stage. Is this the Brewers' opportunity to get past the Dodgers? What do you see happening here?
Well, this is really interesting, Clay, this series, because you've got on the Dodgers side still something of a traditional rotation. And by the way, I loved you've got a very smart, of course, board operator, because you got the We Are Young bringing us into Clayton Kershaw's entrance music. Starts game one, so well done. And that is you've got a great crew there. As you knew that already, Clay, but I'm just telling you, you got a really smart group back there. So I think that Kershaw, he of course wins the game last year to get the Dodgers into the World Series, but he has the really tough outing in game five. I think that he can define his legacy over the next two series. And he now gets the game one start. Of course, he had started game two in the first round where Hyunjin Ryu was so good in game one. But I love the way the Brewers are using their pitching right now. They're thinking of starts and games in two and three inning segments, as opposed to here are my starters. They call them initial out getters as opposed to starters, which I think is great. So it's a fundamental change in philosophy. I think that what we saw in the first round was great by the Brewers. It may have to work a little bit differently in the second round, because I think the Dodgers are a better overall club, and it's harder to use your bullpen that way when you play three straight days as opposed to two straight, those middle games, 3, 4, 5. So I think the Brewers find a way to win this series. I really do. I think that they're just the way they're playing right now is just fascinating. But this is where, if the Brewers win this series, get ready for a fundamental shift in the way baseball is managed and played, because this is still a slightly traditional Dodger rotation against a really modern, smart, thoughtful, avant-garde look at pitching by the Brewers. So, and of course, as you point out, the Brewers have never won the World Series in their history. So no matter what, the winner of the National League is going to be a team with a lot of history there. Either it'll be the Dodgers, who have not won since 88, or the Brewers, who have not been since 82 and have never won it.
If the Red Sox and the Dodgers advance and Clayton Kershaw pitches against David Price, will the world come to an end?
No, I think we'll all be fine, Clay. But it'll be a lot of fun to watch that game. I think Clayton Kershaw, I think his playoff struggles have been not nearly as severe as David's.
Let me jump in here. Do you feel like we talked a lot more about Clayton Kershaw's playoff struggles than David Price's? Because I look at the numbers and see that David Price in games that he started in the postseason is 0-10. And I said, right. My God, like, that's unbelievable when we talk about guys not being able to step up in the moment. I feel like David Price gets a fraction of the attention as Clayton Kershaw. Maybe that's me as a casual baseball fan thinking that. Do you feel that as somebody who covers the game aggressively, that is a difference in the way that they've been treated?
Yeah, well, I think it's not just based on the numbers. I mean, I think of all the times Clayton has pitched on short rest and helped get the Dodgers through to the NLCS. I mean, he's helped his team win series. And last year, he won the clinching game to win the pennant. I mean, Clayton Kershaw has had a lot of iconic, great moments in the playoffs. And really, his failings for a while were almost exclusively in the seventh inning when Don Mattingly did not have enough options to go to in the bullpen. And that's basically, to me, that was how you define Kershaw's struggles. And I think that to lump them together is just not statistically correct. I mean, they're just fundamentally different. And I think you're right that maybe, well, and also, too, Clayton's team was in the playoffs and has been in the playoffs every single year since 2013. So it's been a topic every single fall. Whereas David, I guess, you know, has been as well. He was in there with the Blue Jays in 2015 as well, and he had a decent outing for the Tigers, as I recall it, in 2014. So it was just David's been bouncing around a little bit, where it has not been part of the playoffs every single year in the same way that Clayton has been. So I think you're right that maybe if you've been kind of conflating them together, it's not really correct, because the two resumes are very different. But that being said, they both have some October business to resolve. And I think Clayton's gotten close. Clayton got really close in the World Series last year, and I think now it's a matter of finishing that task before, of course, Clayton becomes a potential free agent if he decides to opt out of his contract. So we've got a lot of really interesting things riding on this. And, oh, by the way, David Price, an opt-out after this season as well. So there are a lot of off-season storylines baked into what's a pretty compelling playoff storyline for both Kershaw and Price.
Outstanding stuff as always, John Morosi. We will talk to you next week. Enjoy that game this weekend, Wisconsin and Michigan up in Ann Arbor.